Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist, with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Jo Leavers about her commercial novel, Tell Me How This Ends. Jo has spent most of her career working on magazines, most recently writing features about homes and interiors for leading newspapers and magazines. She has two grown-up children and lives with her husband and dog in Bristol. In this episode, we discuss how personal loss inspired her story, why adding a mystery element gave the book momentum, and why asking questions during the publishing process is important. But first, here's Jo with an excerpt from Tell Me How This Ends.
Later, Annie gets out the photo albums because they can put pictures in the life story books too. She begins with the old Doyle family album, the one she knows off by heart. And as she turns the last page, a small envelope slips down into her lap. It's the kind a florist might pin to a bouquet, and that's what Annie thinks it is at first, a special message saved from an anniversary, perhaps. But as soon as she opens the envelope, she realises it's nothing of the sort. There is her lovely sister, standing beside her bicycle on the side path to their terraced house. Kath had just got her job at the shoe shop and rode her bike there and back to save on bus fares. Tick, tick, tick went her bicycle wheels every morning as she steered it out onto the pavement. Then she'd be off, standing up on the pedals to get going over the brow of the hill. Glued to the back of the photograph is an official-looking form. In cramped, neat script it reads, Kathleen Doyle, aged 18. Dark brown hair, hazel eyes. Wearing brown suede jacket with fur trim, yellow dress. Last seen 21st December 1974. Annie peels off the form, slides the photograph back into the envelope and replaces it between crackly cellophane pages. That time feels like yesterday but also forever ago. When she looks in the mirror these days, Annie is surprised by the face that peers back at her. Her hair is completely grey. Her skin is a map of lines, all heading downwards. She supposes to other people she looks like an old lady, the kind who has heartwarming anecdotes and smiles at fond, misty memories. She knows that this is what the people at the Rosendale Centre will be expecting. A nice story from a nice old lady. If only I had a happy tale to tell, she thinks. One that's all sunshine and smiles, with all the ends nicely tied up. Unfortunately, that's not the case for Annie Doyle, but next Saturday she will get the free minibus to the centre and she will start telling her story as best she can.
Hi Jo, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on me today to discuss your debut novel, Tell Me How This Ends.
Hi Chloe, I'm really, really happy to be here. Thanks so much.
So Jo, can you start by telling us what your novel is about? Tell us what Tell Me How This Ends is about.
So Tell Me How This Ends follows the story of a woman called Henrietta, who gets a new job transcribing people's life stories. And she works from the Cancer Drop-In Centre. And there she meets Annie, who's her first client. And as soon as Annie starts to tell her life story, she reveals an unsolved crime from 1974. And this was back when Annie was 19 and she had a sister, Kath, who was 18, who drowned in unexplained circumstances. Now, Henrietta had fully resolved to carry out her transcribing job without getting at all emotionally involved, because she's not really much of a people person, as we later discover. But when she hears this confession from Annie, she can't resist launching her own amateur investigation and trying to find out what happened to Kath. And as she digs deeper, the two women grow closer. They form quite a strong bond, and Henrietta ends up having to face ghosts from her own past. So it's a book about grief, that was born of grief, but it's also about hope and how unexpected friendships can change the course of a person's life.
And I want to talk about your kind of the grief aspect a little bit later, but I'd love to hear more about where the inspiration came from, because as I was reading it, I was thinking in my head, it's got to have come between one of two places. So either the kind of mystery element, or perhaps you were inspired by people writing their life stories, because I've heard about a lot of people, you know, when they get to the end of their life, really desperate to have their life kind of in a book somewhere. So where did that spark of inspiration come from?
I guess a bit of both. The spark came really from visiting my mum in hospital after she was diagnosed with cancer. And sadly, she only had 4 weeks between diagnosis and her dying. So there really wasn't much time to kind of talk to her and say, like, hey, remember that story that you told me about, you know, your aunt or about your mum, all those kind of old family stories, because my mum grew up in East London in a working class family. I remember her talking about being evacuated in the war, and then when she got older, she discovered that there was this thing called the Central Line and she could get into London, and this whole new world kind of opened up to her. So I'd kind of heard snippets of stories, but not really listened properly and not realised how important they were. And it really wasn't the time. There were lots of other things to think about then, to sit down and say, you know, tell me about Aunt so-and-so. So it was wishing that I'd done that myself, and then spending time in the cafe in the hospital where she was and looking around and seeing all these other people who were either patients or family, and realizing that they were all going through similar things and they all had stories. Everyone has a life story. You know, people have lived incredible lives, and on the outside they might look perfectly ordinary. And thinking, what happens to all those stories? Wouldn't it be wonderful if they could be recorded and left for people? And then I thought, what would happen if somebody wanted to leave their life story, but they couldn't complete it because there was a mystery, there was an unsolved question in their past? And that's the case for Annie.
So was there a point when you were writing it? I don't know whether you were kind of before you had the idea, or whether you were partway through, where you were like, okay, this is the book. This is the book that's going to get me the book deal, or this is the book that has that spark of potential. Was there a moment when you thought that?
I guess that was when I kind of dreamed up Henrietta as being the counterpoint, the person that pulls these stories together. Because I think before that, I had lots of different scenes flitting around in my head. I had one of the scenes, which remains in the book, but in an altered form, kind of came to me like years before I even thought of writing a book. And it was of two sisters getting ready for a night out. One's wearing a green dress, one is wearing a yellow dress, and they know they look great. And they're going off for a night at the pub, and they push the doors open, and they just wait for a second to make sure that everyone's checked them out, and then they walk in. And I just had that scene, but it didn't have a book to appear in for a long while. So I guess it was once I'd thought of the character of Henrietta and how she also has her own story, but we don't know it yet. But she acts as like a kind of focal point for different people to come and tell their stories. But also, to answer your question, I didn't ever kind of think I'm going to get a book deal, or it's going to be picked for Radio 2, or any of those amazing things. It was just thinking, like, come on, I need to write a book. I've always wanted to. If I don't do it now, no one's going to do it for me. I've just got to get around to it.
So was this a kind of lockdown project for you?
I did do quite a lot of writing in lockdown, but it was more kind of sprang from losing my mum and then a friend who was the same age as me, like quite soon afterwards. And I think that's quite common, that grief does make you reassess things and think about the future, because you realise in that moment that there's nothing you can do to change the past. You can't change the relationships that you had or the choices that you made. All you can do is kind of change a different future, and without wanting to sound like an Insta quote, kind of make a different future for yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us about Henrietta then. She's has such a pivotal role in this novel. And we meet her as she starts this new job transcribing life stories. Can you tell us a little bit more about her character, and also how you created her? How did you kind of get her from an idea to feeling like a real person on the page?
So Henrietta, I guess she kind of reflects how I'm interested in the idea of an outsider, because I think outsiders in stories have quite a unique position because they're observers, and quite often, like Henrietta, they take care not to reveal too much of themselves. So Henrietta really, she has things in her past that she definitely does not want to think about, and she keeps those things at bay by clinging to rules. And she likes her routines. Even when she goes shopping, she takes the same shopping list every week and she buys the same things. She's 30, but basically her life hasn't started. Annie's life is coming to an end, but Henrietta's life has barely started. She doesn't have any friends to speak of at the beginning of the book. On Sundays, she goes and visits her parents for Sunday lunch, which is a weekly trial. And she walks her equally antisocial, problematic dog called Dave. So that's her life. It's very closed off, and very limited. And I guess I wanted to show, as I was saying before, that we can glance see people on the street, or we might see somebody on a bus, and it might be easy to dismiss them, but actually they've got things in their background and their stories that are really important, and have shaped them. And I wanted through the book to kind of have her get in touch with her own past while she's investigating Annie's story as well. So we do see her grow, and come to terms with things that happened.
I mean, that's a sign of a good novel, where your characters, you see their potential at the beginning of what they could be, and by the end, no spoilers, by the end you see them as you'd hope they would be at the beginning of the novel. Annie obviously changes Henrietta's life quite significantly when she comes in to be interviewed, but it's the death of her sister Kath that really haunts Annie and becomes this kind of central mystery in the novel. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that mystery bonds Annie and Henrietta?
Yes, it is. It's quite a pivotal moment when Annie reveals that she had this sister who drowned, who left her clothes by the side of the Grand Union Canal in West London, and was never seen again. And it's that event kind of acts as a gateway for Annie to start thinking more clearly about her past and how much the loss of her sister kind of changed the course of her life, really. She went into a loveless marriage. Her family life kind of fell apart. So it's a trigger for her, but it's also a trigger for Henrietta, who has her own murky past. And the act of Annie opening up and talking to Henrietta helps Henrietta realise that it's time for her to do something similar. And as she starts to dare for the first time to think of Annie as a friend, she wants to share things, because she her rationale is, well, that's what friends do. They share things. And so she does it as a reciprocal act. And Annie kind of makes her see it in a clearer way.
And I wondered whether this kind of mystery element to the novel helps you structure it in some way, because obviously mystery plots have a certain rhythm to them and certain elements. And when you've got a character that wants to find something out, you have to see them going and meeting various people along the way to help them solve this mystery. And I was wondering, did that help you kind of structure the novel? And Are you much of a planner when you when it comes to writing, or not so much?
To be completely honest, the mystery bit kind of came at a later stage when I was doing edits with my agent Hayley. If it had been left up to me, kind of in my naivety, I thought, why can't we just have two women sitting and chatting and telling each other their stories and getting a bit closer, and then that'll be the end. But I don't think you can do that unless you're Sally Rooney, and I'm definitely not. So Hayley was like, you know, you've got to put more of a mystery in, you've got to put red herrings in, you've got to make it more of an investigation. And that did give the book pace, and I had to kind of go and look at writers that I admired that did that brilliantly, like Lisa Jewell and Leanne Moriarty. And I also looked back at Elizabeth Is Missing, Emma Healy's book, and how all those writers kind of lay breadcrumbs, they lay different clues, and some of them are red herrings, and then others are kind of seeds of things that then pop up later in the book. So yes, it was down to Hayley that that structure kind of came into the book and gave it that momentum.
Was that hard to suddenly have this almost, I guess your novel in your head was more of a kind of quieter conversational novel, and then suddenly you have to bring this kind of plot to it that you hadn't expected. Was that difficult to then almost, I mean, and obviously the edits are a hard part, but almost thinking about the novel differently in your head, was that a difficult thing to bring into it, or did you feel that once you knew the mystery, it became easier to slot it into the novel?
It was hard at the beginning, and I think part of that is that resistance that you know, lots of writers do have, like how can you even dream of suggesting that my novel is not perfect? I'm not going to just publish it as it is. And you know, each round of edits, you kind of do that thing of resisting, and then by the end you think, yeah, okay, you had a point. Yeah, that was right. And I think the book is better for it, and I enjoyed it. I kind of ended up thinking up, you know, different people that Henrietta could go and talk to, and whole new scenes came out of that, you know, pubs that she went to, and people that she found on the internet, and that kind of made it fun again. So it kind of took me in a different direction, but one that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I absolutely know what you mean about kind of this idea of the book in your head and how you want it to be. And then someone comes along and says, actually, we need to have the character do this. And you're thinking, well, no, that's not what I planned. That's not what I expected. And I think as well, I know something I find really difficult is that I'd quite be quite happy to just have two characters in a room talking, like you say, and forget about all this kind of active character stuff. I mean, that's really hard. And when you think, oh, I have to push my character into doing things, and maybe it is something about writers being more introverted, or some writers being more introverted, in that, we're quite happy to sit and do things quietly and not push forward and be that active person, but our characters have to be.
No, I still there's still a you know, scenes that I cut that I still mourn and think, oh, why couldn't we have her sitting there and watching this mum doing something? And we didn't have it because we'd already made that point elsewhere of you know, how she's lonely or whatever. But I guess you still have them in your head, don't you? You still kind of know that that's part of their character, and maybe that's the value of the scenes that you cut.
I don't know about you, but I forget what is actually in the book and what has been left on the cutting room floor. And
Yeah,
sometimes
true.
I've had, I don't know, questions at events, or I've met readers and they'll ask me something and I'm thinking, what was in the book? I can't remember. So I wanted to talk about this element of grief that's in your novel, but also I know you made a very conscious effort not to make it a book without hope, or without a kind of an uplifting element as well. What was it that you were kind of hoping to touch on when it comes to dealing with death and grief? And how did you ensure that the book kind of left readers with this like hope, without, again, without spoiling the ending, but how did you kind of leave that the readers with this feeling of hope and not just sadness and loss?
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I think I wanted to set out to write honestly about a person dying and the physical steps, and also about grief. And as one of the characters says quite early on in the book, it's not like on TV and it's not like in films. And I wanted to just put that down on paper. And readers have got in contact with me and which is just incredible, and said, like, thank you for writing that, that put into words, you know, what I experienced, but I couldn't articulate, or that it made them come to a sort of peace by reading it. And that's just incredible. But yes, you're right. I did also want to put in hope and humour, because that is the flip side of grief. It does kind of open up different worlds and different versions of the world for you. I think the humour comes through in the writing. Well, I like to think it does. And also in other characters. So there's characters like Audrey, who's Henrietta's boss. And Henrietta is a tick box person, and she likes to laminate things and she likes her rules. And I think we've all had a boss like Audrey wherever we've worked. And then there's other people that come and tell their life stories. And I think those were opportunities for light humour, not to take the mickey out of them, but to just sort of see the funny side of how people might tell their life story and how they see themselves, but how you can see a different version. So there's Kenton, who writes about his weekends away with his best friend Colin doing bird watching. And we're never quite sure whether Kenton's wife knows what they get up to on the Norfolk Broads. And then there's Gary, who's a former timeshare salesman. And he wants to kind of appease his conscience by writing his life story. So I guess people like that kind of pop in and out of the story and show a lighter side. I think there's always hope. There's always got to be hope as the flip side to grief and to sadness.
Mm, mm. It is difficult, isn't it, when you're dealing with such big topics to, I guess, get that balance right between being true to what grief feels like. And obviously it's worked for your novel and you've had some amazing reviews and people sharing with you how they have felt and how the book has kind of highlighted or vocalized what they wanted to say. But it's also making sure that it's comforting for readers as well, and that they take something away from that, that it's making them feel, you know, it takes away from that element of grief because it's cheered them up, or it's made them feel real warmth or humor towards your characters. And your cast of kind of life story, the people who want their life stories told, is very entertaining, and I'm sure you had a lot of fun coming up with all those unusual characters as well.
They were good fun, yeah. I mean, I guess it could have been a different book, but I think it would have been depressing to write and probably quite depressing to read. So yeah, I did aim for a balance.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've talked about how much of an inspiration your mum was, and also losing your friend as well, that kind of made you think, right, this is the time to write this novel that I've always wanted to do, and to have that kind of leap of faith to do it. Had you ever attempted to write a novel before, or was this your first attempt?
This is genuinely my debut. In my late 20s and early 30s, I think I wrote some kind of flash fiction and short stories, but they didn't really go anywhere. I think I didn't have a voice. I was just trying to be like whatever book I just read, and not very successfully. So that was kind of fun to do. And I did a year of traveling in 1992, and I wrote a diary for that time. But it wasn't a novel. It was just kind of writing things down. So it just kind of, you know, I got on with my career and I had kids, and nothing really came of it. But it was kind of always at the back of my mind. Will I ever get round to doing it? So, yeah, I finally did.
Thank goodness you did. And it's, you know, and I know you've had a brilliant time now that you've been published. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your kind of writing routine. Are you a good person that gets up early in the morning and does, I don't know, a 5 a.m. sprint? What's your kind of, what's your routine? I know you come to my Thursday evening club, so maybe you're more of an evening writer than a morning writer.
Well, I made the massive, put my foot in it with Zoe Ball when I spoke to her and confessed to her that I'd basically didn't get going till about 10 a.m. by which time, like, she's been working for about 4 hours and is clocking off. But that's the truth. I'm not very good at getting up massively early. I work well in the mornings. Probably evenings when I do your sessions is probably more like editing and kind of going over things. Mm-hmm. And getting in just a bit more work if I haven't managed to do much in the day. But my routine, I guess, I either work from a back bedroom or half of a shed, which I've kind of put a partition in. And it's just a kind of breeze block 1980s garage, which I've turned into what I indulgently call my writing shed. And that's where I really work best. Because A, it doesn't have internet, which is a massive distraction for me. And I can just close the door, and it's just like you kind of go into that mood where you think, okay, this is what I'm here for. This is what I'm doing. You can't hear the washing machine finishing its cycle and, you know, making this pinging noise, and you can't go and see what's in the biscuit barrel or make another cup of tea. So that's a kind of I'm really lucky having that space, and that's where I love to write.
That's very principled of you, Jo. I think I'd be like sneaking back into the kitchen, or, you know, going, I'm just going to take a break. And then that 10-minute break turned into an hour break. Or yeah, I'm always very impressed by people who are good at kind of stepping away from the internet. And I know, like you say, it's almost like a enforced break because you can't access it. So
yeah, it's because I have no self-control with that. I have to actually physically put myself in a different world with no internet. I'm too easily distracted otherwise.
And are you someone that's like, you know, got notebooks and post-it notes and everything kind of worked out already before you write, or do you like to kind of discover as you go?
I do discover as I go. I think I'll have like a basic framework for the story. And then other things will kind of come up as I'm writing, and sometimes they won't stay in. It is literally just me kind of getting something out on the page and getting into the story and working out the story as I go. And for my book two, I've had to do a much more detailed kind of chapter breakdown, which has been really useful. But even then, I find myself veering off course and adding in other bits, which will probably get cut. But that's kind of the pleasure of writing, isn't it? Seeing where it goes. I think if it works for some people, but I think if I'm too regimented, then it just feels quite flat.
Mm.
So I think you've got to kind of let yourself go a bit and see where the writing takes you.
So that gives me the impression then that you're someone that just likes to start a new project, blank page, doesn't scare you, you're just happy to get going. Or are you the opposite? You don't like the blank page?
Oh, I don't like the blank page. No, book two was like massively hard to get going on. You kind of look back and think, how did I write a book? How did that happen? Because I really didn't have a clue.
Well, that's the reassuring thing, because you know, you can look on your bookshelf now and be like, I've done it, I've actually finished it. So I can, once I've done it once, it's possible to do it another time.
Yeah, that's the hope.
So I know after you'd written Tell Me How This Ends, you'd entered several competitions and awards, and one of them was the Bath Novel Award, which you were longlisted for, so congratulations for that.
Thank you.
I know you're such a big advocate of entering kind of competitions and prizes. How did the kind of longlisting change things for you? Was it helpful in terms of it made you feel like this, you know, this has something, this has got legs?
Yeah, totally. So I entered about 5, maybe 6 competitions and didn't get anywhere with any of them except for the Bath, which was fantastic. And at that point, I think I only had about 35,000 words, and it was what I'd written kind of in the evenings and at weekends. And I was wondering if really there was any point to it, or if it was just kind of doing what I'd done in my 30s, like just writing for fun, but really it wasn't going to be published. So being longlisted was just amazing. It was a validation, and I'm quite secretive with my writing, which I wouldn't really recommend, but it meant that nobody except my husband had read these words until I sent it off to the competitions. But suddenly it was an awareness that somebody I don't know, I still don't know who the judge was, who longlisted me, but I definitely owe her a drink. Realizing that somebody else has read what you've written and thinking it's all right. Yeah, that was great.
Mm.
So that kind of gave me the confidence and the impetus to finish the book, which I did in a bit of a rush. And then the editing kind of started. But I think just in general, you're right. I do think competitions are useful, because it's gives you a chance to start thinking about your reader, to make that transition from what I was just talking about, like just enjoying the kind of flights of fancy, if you like, and writing on the page and thinking at some point this has to be for a reader if it's going to be a book, and it's got to have that structure, and it's got to have the pace and all those bits that make a book readable, and make the reader want to keep turning the page. So it's thinking about your book in a bigger context.
Mm. And from that point then, was that the thing that prompted you to look for an agent, or had, you know, were you discovered to the longlisting? How did you get your agent?
Well, the Bath Novel Award, I think they kind of feed a few names to agents, but my book was really quite rough and ready at that point. So I did have interest from one agent then, and I probably shouldn't have sent it off to her, because it wasn't in great shape. So I didn't hear back, and I wasn't surprised really. So then I did lots more editing, lots more kind of adding to it. And I approached about 6 or 7 agents. And I heard back from Hayley Steed at Madeline Milburn very swiftly. And we had a Zoom meeting, and we just got on really well. And I felt really confident that she got the book, and she said great things about it. And I liked the agency, I liked the books and the writers that they represented. And I also found that whole process, as everyone, I'm sure, sending off your stuff to agents, really stressful. So I thought, well, what do I do? Do I kind of wait and tie myself in knots and then, you know, have another meeting with another agent, and then I might go with Hayley anyway. So I just thought, right, I'm just going to make a decision, go with her. And I withdrew from the other agents.
And what was the
exactly with that decision.
Process like between signing with Hayley and getting your book deal? Was there a kind of a long time in between? Did you do a lot of editorial work? What was that process like?
That was quite interesting, because I think it, as a debut, you've got no kind of prior knowledge. As you've worked in the book industry, you've got no prior knowledge of how long is, like, in inverted commas, normal. And I kept thinking, like, am I being really rubbish? Is this taking forever? Is she, like, losing hope? Like, thinking, oh God, I wish I hadn't chosen her. But I think it was pretty standard. We did three quite strong rewrites. It took about 6 or 7, maybe 8 months, and then we went on submission. But yeah, it's just that thing of the whole kind of publishing world being a little bit opaque, and you know, maybe you shouldn't be comparing yourself to other people, because everyone's journey and everyone's book is really different. But that's how long it took for me. And it was a better book by the time that we went on submission.
I think it massively varies. And I think, like everything, there is no point in comparing yourself to other people, mm-hmm. because every book's different. Every book needs different kind of hands-on work. Some books need, you know, lots of changes. Some books you and your agents discuss and you know, you decide to make a massive change. I know I drove my agent mad by writing an extra 75,000 words, which I didn't need.
Wow.
So it's, you know, I think that every book has a different journey, and that can be frustrating, but also, you know, it's one of the things that we as authors have to deal with. One amazing thing that's happened to you since getting your book deal, and we have to talk about this, is you were on the BBC Radio 2 book club with Zoe Ball. What was that like? Tell us about that experience, because I mean, I think everyone that saw this happen was just so happy for you, Joe, and also just, I mean, extremely jealous as well, obviously, but, you know, incredibly happy for you. So tell us what that experience is like.
It was really amazing. It was like, it's so hard to talk about things like this without, like, reverting to cliches, but there were, when I was sitting in the studio opposite Zoe Ball, I had like this almost out of body experience where I thought, is this really happening, or is it just a really long dream? It's like, if you put that in a book, you'd think that's really poor writing. Like, it felt like a dream, but it actually did. So I'd heard that they were putting it forward, publishers and the PR team. And I'm a bit of a natural pessimist, so I was like, yeah, no, that's not going to happen. they're just saying this. And then it did, which was amazing. And I later found out that the books that go through for the our picks for the Radio 2 Book Club, they're chosen by librarians, which is just lovely, because I think they're thinking about reading groups and kind of a broad spectrum of people, and books that have lots of themes, and that's really what I wanted for my book from the outset, for people to discuss the themes that it brings up, not just kind of the mystery element at the heart of the book. So yeah, I was really pleased to imagine that book clubs would be reading my book. That's kind of what I dreamed for it.
It is such an ideal book for that discussion, and I think hopefully that program has helped raise your profile, and but lots more people will be discovering your book. I would love to hear a little bit about your kind of thoughts in general about what it's been like to be a debut novelist, and kind of what the publishing process has been like for you. Has there been anything that's been surprising or challenging, or anything that you think, oh, I wish I'd known this before it all began? You know, what advice would you give to anyone that was about to become a debut novelist?
Yeah, I think it's also worth mentioning, like, I'm quite a late debut. I'm in my 50s. So just don't give up. Like, it's always worth doing. It's always worth trying. I don't think there's any age cutoff. I guess my advice would be always ask questions, because I think agents and publishers forget that we're doing this for the first time. You know, they live and breathe this publishing world. They know the kind of timescales for things. They know when book covers are decided. They know how much input you can have into that. But we don't. So just to ask those questions and just be completely honest and say, I don't understand what this term means, or, you know, how much editing am I supposed to do at proofreading stage? What can I do? Those kind of things. And I think in general, you know, lots of writers say this, but find your tribe, find the people on Twitter that are going to support you and be in that same position, because they're a massive support. They really are. They've been great. And also set your own boundaries. Everyone's book is personal to them. It's going to have some part of their personality in it. And when it gets to the point of doing PR, or just how much time you physically spend on doing promotion and thinking about your book, kind of have those boundaries, because having a book published is amazing. It's fantastic. But there's a whole world of life out there that doesn't center around books. And sometimes it's good to remember that as well. That it's just one part of your life. There's other parts and other people that are equally important.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think we talk a lot, don't we, about how much as a writer we can actually control. And I think sometimes if you sit there and panic over things that are happening that you can't control, it's not going to do you any good. And I think we've spoken, debuts have spoken recently about kind of mental health struggles, particularly in the debut year. And I think a lot of that comes down to this idea of you're losing control, because your book at the beginning is yours totally. And then it goes out into the world and suddenly you don't have any say, you don't have any control. You just have to cross your fingers and hope that everything's going to be okay and people enjoy it and the publishing team do a great job. And all those things are completely out of your control. And I think that's the challenge, isn't it? And like you say, making sure that your life is not just book the whole time is a really helpful thing.
Yeah, and trust the process, because, you know, the people that are editing, they know what they're doing. They want it to be a success as well. Trust your agent when they tell you things. Yeah, because they do that every day of their working lives, and they've been doing it for years. So sometimes you just have to go with the flow.
Yeah, sometimes, again, talking about control, you have to just sit back and just be happy that you're not doing it. And it's a challenge. It is difficult. But I think it's something, like with everything, when you face rejections, you have to just accept them. And when you become published, you have to just go, okay, that's not my job anymore. I've done my bit. I've done my writing. That's it.
You're right. There's a bigger picture. It's like, the agents that don't want you, or the publishers that don't want you, that's not a personal decision. That's because of the market or something else that they've got, or because they weren't in a very good mood that day, or whatever. Those things are not actually about you. So you control the things that you can do, and let other people get on with their part of the process.
So you've briefly talked about how book two has been a bit more challenging and involved a bit more focused kind of plotting. So finally, Jo, can you tease us, what are you writing at the moment?
Actually, that's something I was going to say in the previous question, like tips for other writers. Have some ideas lined up for book two, but when your agent goes out on submission, so that she can go to publishers and say, and, you know, there's this other fantastic idea lined up.
That's a great tip, actually, because that's something I hadn't thought of when I went out on submission and suddenly had a panic and was like, what am I going to say? So yeah, absolutely great tip.
And also to have something for yourself to fall back on, because you spend so much of your time thinking, breathing, dreaming about book one, and then you've got to kind of put that baby to one side and go to book two. And it's quite hard to make the transition, but if you've had something kind of bubbling away at the back of your mind that you already feel the love for, that you already feel invested in, then it's a lot easier to get into it. My book two, at the beginning of this year, I ditched 70,000 words of a book two that just wasn't working, just wasn't right. My heart wasn't in it. I think I was still thinking about Annie and Henrietta and kind of missing them. So now I'm on a different version of book two, which is about mother and daughter bonds. It's about a mother and daughter that have been estranged for 20 years and how they hopefully find their way back to each other. And I wanted to be kind of go a lot deeper into emotions, because Annie and Henrietta are quite closed off from their feelings. They take a lot of time getting to the heart of things and kind of admitting how they feel. But this one, I kind of wanted to go in a lot faster and harder into that mother-daughter bond and the emotions that it brings up, and pregnancy. So that's what book two is about.
Well, that sounds really interesting, Jo, and I'm sure delving into their kind of inner thoughts and their emotions is going to be a challenge. But I know, having read your first book, I know that you are very good at getting into kind of the deeper character emotions. So I'm looking forward to reading it. And thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today, Jo.
Oh, no, thank you. It's a real pleasure.
That was Jo Leavers talking about her commercial novel, Tell Me How This Ends, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.